That quirk of birth, in fact, characterised his personality and passions in many ways. He had been an early supporter of the suffragettes. An article on their major march on Washington was headlined, 200 women and one bachelor. And that bachelor was Leonard Grossman. He was the type of person who always managed to get into the picture whenever a newspaperman happened to be near. He had worked as a stringer for various papers when he first left law school, and his nose for a story never quite left him. He was a brilliant orator. Grossman had been involved in politics in the past, yet it was workmen's compensation cases that really inspired him. He had a passion for the working person and for people who were in trouble, said his son, Len. He never went for the big buck. Sometimes he didn't even go for the small buck. He took shoes as fees, remembered his son. He did that way too often. This may explain why, in July 1937, despite the seeming glamour of his office, Grossman was kind of on the outs, scraping it together. But it didn't matter to him. Money wasn't what drove Grossman. His principles were his fuel. This was the man, his passions and priorities, into whose office the five women of Ottawa walked. It was, perhaps, the most perfect meeting of minds. "We were at our wits' end when he came to our rescue," remembered Catherine Donahue. "He had no thought of money. He just wants to help us girls, to help humanity." Grossman declared to his new clients, "My heart is for you. I am happy to be in this fight for you." At last, the women had a legal champion, and they had found him not a moment too soon. In 2 days' time, Grossman and the girls had a hearing to attend before the Illinois Industrial Commission. Step by step, inch by inch, Catherine and the other girls made their slow way to the Yellowstone LaSalle County Courthouse on Friday, 23rd of July. It was just 4 blocks south of St. Columba, so they did not have far to go. When they arrived, they were gratified to see that their story was being covered by the press. It was a boost that Catherine in particular needed. In the short time since she'd been in Grossman's office in Chicago, another piece of her jawbone had come out into her mouth. Not knowing what to do with it, she had put it in a small paper pillbox. Despite her trials, Catherine that day seemed to take inspiration from Grossman, finding fuel in her principles, in standing up for what was right. She presided over the reporters as she and the other girls spoke to the press. As the women entered the courtroom and saw Grossman there, ready to do battle for them, they knew that, this time, they stood a fighting chance. Some of the women sat at the counsel table with Grossman as he prepared to open their case. Representing Radium Dial were the same legal firms who had fought, and won, the Inez Valla case 2 years earlier. The leading lawyer was Arthur Madgett, a young-looking man with thick, dark hair and glasses. Another was Walter Bachrach. Grossman's first job was to ask for a postponement to give him time to familiarise himself with the case and to trace, if possible, the old company's assets. Madgett readily agreed. The firm was in no rush for the trial to begin, for the longer the legal process could be stretched out, the weaker the women would be. There was not much more to that first hearing, although Bachrach did now reveal what the company's defence would be. He said he would contend the paint was not poisonous and that none of the women actually were suffering from radium poisoning. Not poisonous.